Just to orient you, we're going to start with Dr. Michelle Ostrad. Then we're going to lead into Ken Martinez. Then I'm going to give my presentation. We're going to then lead into Suzanne Maria and end with Anna Fenley. And just the general order of the presentations will be, we're going to start with a technical overview of nanotechnology. Just a show of hands, how many of you are familiar with what nanoparticles are and nanotechnology is? Okay. So that's wonderful. That gives us an opportunity to also maybe try to tailor the presentation a bit too. And then we're going to talk about technical aspects of, especially of assessment and monitoring of nanoparticles in the workplace. Then we're going to move into more a social aspect of nanotechnology and nanoparticles. We're going to talk about cultural safety. We're going to talk about regulatory and legal aspects of nanotechnology and worker health, occupational health. And then we're going to conclude with Anna's presentation on a union perspective on nanotechnology and occupational health. So with that, I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Michelle Ostrad. Dr. Ostrad is the Senior Director for the Center for Aerosol and Nanomaterials Engineering at RTI International. And in her position, she provides technical leadership, strategic direction, and business development to an interdisciplinary staff of over 35 professional scientists and engineers. Dr. Ostrad has more than 15 years of experience in the area of aerosol science and nanotechnology. Before joining RTI, she worked at DuPont's experimental station with primary responsibility in the aerosol synthesis and characterization of submicron and nanoparticles for a variety of electronic and materials applications. Dr. Ostrad has authored numerous research publications in the areas of aerosol nanoparticle synthesis, characterization, and electrical properties, holds 9 patents, and has given over 60 conference presentations, invited talks, and guest lectures. At the international level, Dr. Ostrad is a U.S. delegate and technical expert in ISO TC229 nanotechnologies, and she has also recently spent several months in Saudi Arabia to investigate business and government needs in implementing applied research capabilities at the national level. She has earned her PhD in 2001 in chemical engineering from the California Institute of Technology. With that, I'd ask you to join me in welcoming Dr. Ostrad.
Okay, so can everyone hear me? Okay, speak up a little bit more. I don't think this microphone is as good. If you can't hear me, please just let me know even throughout the talk. Okay, so I was asked to give kind of a little bit of background on nanotechnology and on nanomaterials. So the first portion of my presentation, I'm going to spend some time talking about why nanotechnology is important, what it is, and why we're kind of working on it from a science, product development, commercialization aspect. And then I'm going to move more into the actual title of my talk, which is talking with you and presenting a tool that is used to be able to help assess environmental and biological implications of nanomaterials. So nanotechnology. Basically, the understanding of it, and many people consider nanomaterials and nanotechnology really to be focused on materials that have dimensions less than 100 nanometers. And that is certainly one important aspect of nanotechnology and nanomaterials. But I think there's another one also that's also very critical, which is the understanding and control of these materials. And the reason why that's important is because by understanding and controlling them, we can be able to exploit many of their size-dependent phenomena that tend to occur. And it's one of the reasons why we're so interested in them as scientists and engineers, as well as in product developers and people who are interested in commercialization of technology. On the lower graph, what you can see is kind of an indication of the length scale that we're talking. If you go from all the way from 1 nanometer all the way up to 100 microns, you can see different characteristic length scales, everything from human hair, which is around 25 microns, down to red blood cells, which are 6 to 8 microns in diameter, visible light, which is between 400 and 700 nanometers. But once you get below about 100 nanometers, you see that these materials definitely have length scales of biological relevance. The AIDS virus is 95 nanometers. The mean free path in air, or that's an aerosol term, used to identify the length scale of air molecules as they just move in air before they collide with each other. And then DNA, which has a dimension of 2 nanometers as its diameter, really shows you that nanomaterials are in the size regime where they have extreme biological relevance. When you think about the two aspects of the definition that I talked with you about earlier, the first one was understanding and control. And I think as a nanotechnologist, I've heard many times that people say, well, nanotechnology is not really new. It's been around for thousands of years. There are examples of it in cave paintings. There are examples of it in stained glass from medieval times, for example. And that's true. Nanomaterials really do impart some very novel optical characteristics of glass, for example, of glazing. Carbon black is also used as a filler in tires. Okay, so these materials have been around for a very long time, but I think the difference now is that we're actually able to understand them and control the size-dependent phenomenon in some pretty novel ways. Again, the size between 1 and 100 nanometers, it's a convenient definition. Being less than 100 nanometers is relatively straightforward. But again, I believe the reason why the length scale is so important is, again, because it talks about dimensions that are really very biologically relevant. So I'm going to spend the next couple of slides trying to excite you on nanotechnology and on nanomaterials and explain some of the really interesting types of applications and products that are already being enabled by nanotechnology. So size-dependent phenomena can include electrical characteristics. And nanomaterials are truly one of the reasons why we've been able to put so many transistors on a wafer, why your computer costs have gone down exponentially. It's because the length scales are in the nanoscale size range. They require less power. They're faster. And so nanotechnology is truly enabling the computer revolution. From an optical perspective, these materials are actually quite amazing. Materials that have identical chemistry, have identical compositions, can begin to emit or fluoresce light at different wavelengths. And it's because solely to their size-dependent phenomenon. There's many exciting medical and energy efficiency applications. We use these, for example, now to be able to manipulate and control the interaction of energy with light. And you've probably seen, if you've looked at some pretty basic nanotechnology and nanomaterial papers, a picture very similar to what's in the upper left-hand corner, where just by simply changing the particle size, you can change the apparent light or the wavelength that is emitted from those particles. From a structural perspective, I never think a presentation is complete without images of geckos. And so these animals are actually quite amazing because they're able to crawl up featureless surfaces. They can just crawl right up a pane of glass. And it's because of the nanoscale fibers that exist at the ends of the pads of their feet. It's because of these nanoscale features that really gives them a very huge amount of surface area. And so when you have a very large surface area basically interacting with structures, you can easily crawl up a side of glass. You basically think about the surface area that a gecko has on each of its paws. It's probably the same square the surface area of a football field. And when you start being able to do that with something as light as a gecko, you can actually see how you can start using the van der Waals forces and some of these other kinds of forces to be able to provide very strong adhesives without having any kind of liquid involved. And so that's definitely what a group at UC Berkeley is doing, where they're able to provide extremely good adhesive materials simply by exploiting the high surface area of nanomaterials. Another example is in wetting phenomenon. Many of you may be familiar with the lotus effect. This is a material found in nature on the lotus leaf, which is actually able to very efficiently repel water due to the nanostructure of the surface itself. And what happens is water droplets are not able to contact the surface very well, and so when they come in contact with it, they are just immediately brushed off. And so when you put water on a lotus leaf, for example, it just collects in the center of the leaf, as shown in the upper left-hand corner. A product application for this are the new nano-enabled self-cleaning glasses that are starting to come out in the market, where when raindrops fall on them, It actually just cleans right off, and you don't have to worry about cleaning the glass. So you're starting to see some of these nanoscale applications starting to hit the market. Nanoscale enhanced energy efficiency is everywhere. And just a couple of examples, and this comes from a paper by Gibbs. It just looks at a couple of areas in which nanotechnology is really starting to enhance fuel efficiency and fuel economy of automobiles. Everything from fuel additives to be able to produce better fuel efficiency, nanocomposites that are used to make lighter car bodies and also plane bodies for that matter, and then catalysts that are helping to reduce emissions coming from tailpipes are all areas in which nanotechnology is really starting to enhance energy efficiency and applications. So some of the key attributes to nanomaterials that enable all of these amazing kind of phenomenon, in addition to their quantum confinement, which is largely electrical and optical type effects, these materials have extremely high surface areas. If you think about the number of surface atoms per bulk in a nanomaterial, it's actually quite large. It allows these materials to be highly functionalized, to be able to put a lot of different kinds of materials on the surface, but also to be able to interact with an environment so that it can actually bring a lot of different kinds of materials where they might not occur. They are very responsive to chemical environments as well as to the to atmospheric sciences, for example. And you can have a very strong interactions of the surface chemistry with the environment or with a biological system. And again, as I mentioned before, they have extremely small sizes. This not only influences their quantum effect, but they can physically fit through very small spaces or pores. They're also able to interact with biological systems, but they also provide you very unique detection signatures. So I know I went through this very, very quickly, but I wanted to give you a very high-level overview of nanotechnology and nanomaterials. So now as I move into the talk on the nanomaterial registry, this is really a tool that is used to help researchers, product developers, government regulators, very broad stakeholders, to be able to start assessing the biological and environmental implications of nanomaterials. There's a couple of extremely big challenges in being able to do something like this. First of all, nanotechnology is not an industry, but is an enabling technology. And the reason why I think it's important to say that is because you can't just go to the car industry or to water sanitation and address everything you would need to know about nanotechnology. You're going to find nanotechnology in medicine. You're going to find it in electronics. You're going to find it in lasers. So it's going to be all over that you're going to start seeing nanotechnology and the advances from it. The applications for nanotechnology are extremely diverse. In the previous couple of slides, I just showed you a very few number of applications in which nanotechnology actually applies. There is an exponential growth in nanotechnology across broad industries. This is not only, you can not only see this in the investment from government funding, but also industrial funding, issued patents, number of manuscripts, protocols that are being published throughout the world. One of the issues with that is that a significant amount of the amount of information on nanotechnology, I would say 15 years ago, someone could say, I'm an expert in nanotechnology, and you would have been able to read most, if not all, of the manuscripts in the area and consider yourself an expert in the field. Now, I mean, there are thousands of journals. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of conferences a year that you can go to hear about or learn about nanotechnology. It's virtually impossible to really stay current in all areas of nanotechnology. And so what we've started to do as nanotechnologists is specialize in certain areas. And nanotechnology continues to be an emerging area of high activity. It's very important. There's a lot of commercial relevance, and a lot of people are working on this. The image on the right-hand side, just for those of you who are not familiar with it, it's actually an image of zinc oxide made in the nanoscale, and you can just see the tremendous diversity in the actual morphology of the material. It's something as simple as zinc oxide. You can see that being able to manipulate this material in such striking morphological ways actually is one of the reasons why nanotechnology is so exciting but also so incredibly challenging. So the nanomaterial registry. In the previous slide, I talked with you about some of the challenges, and now what I'm going to talk with you about is a tool that we're developing to be able to help address some of those challenges and to be able to help bring all of the information on nanomaterials and their biological and environmental implications into one resource. The idea for the nanomaterial registry is to be an authoritative resource, almost like a one-stop shop. If you have a question about some kind of interaction of a nanomaterial with some biological or environmental system, you can come to the registry to find out some information about that, and hopefully it would point you to additional resources. Because nanotechnology is so broad, it requires a very broad stakeholder involvement, and so we've included a lot of experts from across industry, regulatory, government, and academia to be a part of this program. It is funded by NIBIB, NIEHS, and NCI. These are three institutes from the National Institutes of Health. And on the lower left-hand side, you can see some of the participants who are advisory board members in the nanomaterial registry. Some of the significant long-term aspects of this tool include being able to develop new models, assay standards, and manufacturing methods for nanomaterials, accelerating the translation of nanomaterials into new interesting applications, and to be able to promote standardization in the nanomaterial community. So some of the priorities for the nanomaterial registry. For those of you who have not been immersed in nanotechnology for a very long time, this is actually a very, very daunting program. Because part of the challenge we have is that nanomaterials right now are not exceptionally well characterized. Before they're put into products, before they're synthesized, or they might be disclosed in a manuscript or in a patent. And part of the issue is that if you don't identify or characterize a nanomaterial, it's very difficult to understand how it's going to interact biologically or environmentally. So right now, the way it's done, researcher takes a material, tests it for some biological assay. Then they do a new material. And it's very, very expensive. It's very, very time-consuming, and it's very, very costly. And what we're trying to do with the registry is actually try to distill down what are the essential information about nanomaterials that need to be known or need to be reported so that we can actually advance the science to be able to start developing predictive tools that indicate whether or not a material may have biological or environmental relevance. And to be able to start influencing the community to standardize some of its methods, some of its vocabulary, some of its procedures. Additionally, the nanomaterial registry has to actually function as a database as well as a nice website. So with this, some of the priorities include the minimal information standards. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about this in the next couple of slides, but this is really the minimal amount of information someone would need to know about a nanomaterial in order to determine its biological or environmental interactions. Because we want this resource to be authoritative, all of the information in the registry is curated by nanomaterial experts. We are working on consistent vocabularies, and I'll talk about that in the next couple of slides. Interoperability with various data sources. And obviously it's going to include a collaboration across a very broad nanomaterial research community. Some of the information that goes into the minimal information about nanomaterials is not only its physicochemical characteristics or something such as particle size, aggregation state, or composition, surface chemistry, but it also has to do with the biological and environmental interactions or outcomes. So this is what we consider to be our study data. With the minimal information about nanomaterials that we are developing, then curating, the output from the nanomaterial registry allows users to be able to do such things as browse, search, and also identify when a nanomaterial may be similar to another nanomaterial. And I'll get into that in a little bit more detail later. So some of the minimal information about nanomaterials for physicochemical characteristics, the nanomaterial registry team has determined that these are at least the initial 12 physicochemical characteristics that we are capturing in the nanomaterial registry. For those of you who are involved in the field, many of these are going to be very familiar to you. You may be surprised that some of them made the list, and you also may be surprised that some of them aren't on the list. And one of the things I would say about the nanomaterial registry is we agree that there isn't 100% consensus that these are the 12 correct ones, but we decided it was very important to actually put a line in the sand and actually start working on the registry. And as new information comes in, we would be able to update this tool with new information. So this is an evergreen website. I'm going to talk a little bit about the importance of controlled vocabulary, because I know in one case it's a lot of fun to make up new words and to make up new terms for some of the materials that one might create. When you deal with a simple part of nanotechnology on the left-hand side, you see things like spheres, rods, and plates. And those are very, very easy to identify and to differentiate. But that's very rarely the real world in nanotechnology. What the real world looks like in nanotechnology is on the right-hand side, where you have forests of nanotubes. You might have aggregates and agglomerates of not only nanotubes, but particles, metal catalysts. They sometimes call them bird's nests, for example. You could also have rings, helices. These are materials that are very, very complex. And I think one of the things we struggle with in the nanomaterial community is how do you actually describe some of these things. And I always like it when I get a paper that says, like, we made a nano basket, or we made a nano flower or nano tuba. Okay, that's fine. I mean, and the pictures look nice, and you can get some great graphics out of it, but it's very difficult from the perspective of actually starting to put that together in a controlled vocabulary way. So that someone who says, I have a nano petal, they say, oh, I know exactly what that means, as opposed to something a little bit more typical, which would be like a carbon nanotube. So we really struggle in this community to work on the controlled vocabulary to make sure it's very consistent and people understand what they mean when they name something a certain way. Another important thing about nanomaterials is that it's really not enough to just say, oh, my particle is 25 nanometers and move on. It's because the methods, the protocols, the instruments, all very much influence what that particle size is actually determined to be. And just to give you an example, on the right-hand side, you can see that using five different nanoscale materials, depending upon the solution you pick, water, PBS, or F12K media, you can get a different aggregate size in solution. And so it's important to report some of these protocols, methods, instruments, when you are saying what your particle size might be. In many of these cases, too, not only do the solutions or the media influence the aggregate size, they could also influence the surface charge, many other parameters. And so what we're doing in the registry is not only looking at the physicochemical characteristic, but we're actually looking at what instrument was it used, what are the critical parameters, what was the pH of the solution, was it sonicated before or after, so that people can really start to understand how when they change from water to PBS, how is their particle size going to change. So as you can imagine, if you have 12 PCC, those are the indicators in the pink, you have different kinds of measurement types for each PCC, you have different techniques, protocols, and parameters for each of the instruments, for each of the techniques, you can see that this database becomes absolutely enormous. And I would say the advantage of the registry is that we've been able to leverage a lot of the nanoinformatics and informatics tools that now are starting to exist, very good search algorithms out there, to be able to start collecting this huge amount of data on nanomaterials. Our struggle actually is that we have this registry capable of capturing all of this information because we believe it is truly important and critical to characterize your materials this way. But very, very few studies right now are actually going to this level of detail. And I think the next steps are going to be that we're going to be able to start influencing the researchers and the people who are generating this information to really to be able to disclose much more about their protocols and procedures than they have in the past. I would say similarly, we have a huge amount of data that we're able to collect for biological studies, environmental studies, and ecological studies. And I don't have very much time, so what I'm going to do is gloss over some of these. But if you have any questions or you'd like additional information about this, please let me know. And my contact information was on the first slide, and I also have some cards to pass out if you want to get more information on the registry. So at a very high level, the nanomaterial registry is live. You can go to it today. Our goal is to really start adding more nanomaterials to it. Right now, we only have a few hundred, but our goal is to get in the tens or hundreds of thousands of nanomaterials over time. A couple of things you can do with it. These are screenshots from the registry. You can do browse. So if you're not really sure what you're looking for, you can just come to the registry and actually browse what's available. You can also do advanced search. And again, another screenshot where you can do some pretty specific searching if you know what you're looking for. You can do a comparison. This is my CarMax page, basically where you want to compare three different cars, you want to compare three different nanomaterials with each other, you can do that. And what it does is it lines up side by side so that you can get an indication of different kinds of nanomaterials with each other. Matching, which I think is going to become a very, very critical feature as more nanomaterials get entered into this database. Basically, what you're going to be able to say is, how similar is this nanomaterial to others in the database? And I think what that's going to be able to do is start really driving towards more predictive tools and models to be able to look at what key characteristics or features of nanomaterials might be showing a similar kind of biological or environmental interaction. So the matching tool, I think, is going to become very, very critical. We also have very extensive details pages and best practice questions so that you can, for example, print out, if you wanted to, some of these pages might be 20 pages long because there's a lot of information on them, about a lot of the details of nanomaterials that are in the registry. And then compliance levels. This is actually one of the more contentious aspects to the nanomaterial registry, but what we're actually doing is ranking the quality and quantity of data that exists for nanomaterials. And so if you report 25 nanometers, we're going to say, well, that's fine, but that really doesn't help. As opposed to someone who might show a graphical image, they say 25 nanometers measured in with DLS, with this pH, sonicated after this much time. So the more information you provide and the more complete your information is, the higher your compliance score. And it's going to give people an ability to say, you know what, I only want to use the data in my study that's of the highest quality and the highest quantity. Partnerships for the registry are critical. And that's one thing I would like to reemphasize to this crowd, is that we've got these tools, we've got this database, we've got this capability, but we're really looking for additional partnership opportunities for people who might have data, who might want to be able to share or put their information into the registry over time. And so with that, I will actually conclude. Yeah, he gave me 2 minutes, but I was almost towards the end. I'd encourage you to please visit the Nanomaterial Registry site. If you can contact us if you have any questions or if you'd like feedback or if you'd like to figure out how to partner. If there are features you'd like to see, for example, this definitely is a community-based effort, and we want to build it based upon the input from a wide variety of stakeholders. Thank you.